Roundtable Osteuropa. Ein Podcast des Zentrums für Osteuropa und internationale Studien.
Welcome. In this new episode of Roundtable Osteuropa, we want to continue our discussion about Belarus, a country that for most Europeans still marks a blank spot on their mental maps. Politically, Belarus sits uncomfortably between Russia and the EU. Relations with Russia are much closer, not least due to Belarus's economic dependence on Russia's resources. Under the authoritarian president, Alexander Lukashenko, the links to the EU have been limited, and Belarus has not been a fully-fledged Eastern Partnership country. The Eastern Partnership policy is the EU's framework aimed at deepening integration with the EU without actual EU membership. Countries participating are Ukraine, Moldova, Georgia, Armenia, and Azerbaijan. In a previous episode of Roundtable Osteuropa, before the parliamentary elections in Belarus in mid-November, we had discussed, in German, the run-up to these elections and a number of issues related to domestic politics and foreign policy. Today, we want to take stock of the situation after the elections and focus on one particular segment of Belarusian society, youth. What do young people think? What do they want? How do they make themselves heard? Our focus today is on Belarusian youth, but the discussion speaks to a wider topic, the role of youth in authoritarian countries. Young people can be both a support pillar of the regime or an unpredictable and ultimately risky group. Questions we want to ask today are, do we know what young people think and expect in Belarus? How do we find out? Does youth matter in an authoritarian country? And why and how? At SOIS, one of our four research clusters is dedicated to youth in Eastern Europe. SOIS senior researcher Dr. Felix Krawacek is in charge of this research cluster. He is a political scientist by background and has worked on youth in different political settings for a long time. He's with us in the studio today. Welcome, Felix.
Hello.
Our second guest is Maria Rochova. She's a doctoral candidate at the University of Oslo. Her doctoral thesis focuses on the aspects of everyday nationalism in authoritarian societies. Before joining the University of Oslo, she worked as a research assistant on multi-level governance of the European Union at the European Institute of Public Administration in Barcelona. She's from Belarus and has recently returned from a longer visit. My name is Gwendolyn Sasse. I'm the director of ZEUS. Maria, maybe we can start with you and you can share some fresh impressions right away from your visit to Belarus. Maybe you can tell us a bit about the elections, where we are now, put the results in perspective.
I think there, first of all, we have to say about the results. So we don't have any oppositional candidates as in previous convocation of their parliament. It's important as well to say that there are two chambers of the parliament. There is the upper chamber, the Council of the Republic, and then the House of Representatives. In their upper chamber, the election happened a week prior to their mass elections to the House of Representatives. So what we see as well right now that in their House of Representatives, there are no oppositional candidates, and the elections were considered that they didn't follow the international standards on free and fair elections. This is kind of a general overview of what happened. And then, of course, there are other restrictions that didn't allow our oppositional candidate to enter the parliament, and their entire political campaign was also restrictive in terms of access to media, in terms of access to public spaces that didn't allow the campaign to be considered as free and fair.
Can you unpack this for us a little bit and tell us, how do we have to imagine this? Are there no opposition candidates whatsoever in parliament? I mean, there are various parties. Are there parties only in name, or do they differ in any way?
So now among 110 elected MPs, there are 21 representatives of political parties. They were nominated by political parties and then they will represent political parties. But most of those candidates, they represent the Communist Party of Belarus, also a Republican Party of Labour and Justice, and Liberal Democratic Party. All these parties are, in their name, are pro-governmental parties. Liberal Democratic parties, they kind of indicate that they are oppositional, but they identify themselves as constructive opposition. So there is only one member of this party in the House of Representatives. There is also other kind of political kind of aspects in this among those MPs. There are six members from Belarusian Republic Union of Youth, BRSM in Russian or Belarusian, and there are 66 representatives of another public association, which is Belarus, which is not a political party, but it's a public association. So they were not able to nominate their candidates as a political party, but they were still supporting them in their election campaign, and they will be representing Belarus in the parliament.
Has there been any significant change, or maybe even any small change? You gave us the numbers now and how roughly the various parliaments align in parliament. Where do you see changes, if anywhere?
What was surprising for me, I think, in this election was the role of political parties, even pro-governmental political parties, I would say, because I think it becomes harder even for pro-governmental parties to collect signatures, because the society at large are not really engaged in a way that they don't want to provide signatures for pro-governmental parties, so it becomes much harder to collect those signatures from population. Therefore, even pro-governmental parties started to play a certain role. So political nomination of a political party becomes more important in this political system. So it's interesting to observe this. And 21 representative is definitely more indicating that this is much stronger role that political parties are playing in this government. It's also interesting that basically, like, the winning combination for many MPs to be elected was a nomination from Labour Collective, which is like this kind of stranger nomination routine. So you have to collect signatures from your kind of Labour or employer. Basically, if your employer has more than 300 employees, they can nominate you as the running candidate in this election. So it seems to be a very kind of winning combination, this being nominated by Labour Collective plus maybe collecting some signatures. And most of them, especially those running from Belarus, were nominated that way.
You just said that it was getting harder also for pro-government parties to collect the necessary signatures. Why is that, and how should we interpret this?
I think it's also different how this kind of collection of signatures were in different regions, but what I maybe could have been observed in Minsk that people didn't want to give their signatures for pro-governmental candidates. Many oppositional candidates were doing as well, collecting signatures, and you can see different activities that are happening at their signature station because they were organizing picketing for collecting signature and canvassing, so door-to-door activities for collecting signatures. So people were much more willing to give their signature for oppositional candidates and less willing to give signatures, I think, for pro-governmental parties, because I think this is a just different I think this indicates a different dynamic in the society, that they are not willing to participate in a certain way as the government doesn't provide them enough opportunities to participate in a certain way. This is why it was a protest, kind of indication of a certain protest to give a signature for a positional candidate. They were much more willing to do that than for pro-government.
That's interesting what you say. It suggests certain societal changes, even though we might not see them at the level of who actually gets elected in parliamentary elections. Let's bring you in as well, Felix. How do you see the role of these parliamentary elections in Belarus's political system, parliamentary elections in an authoritarian system?
Yeah, I think the first point to underline, as Maria also did, is it's quite a step backwards. I mean, the symbolic pluralism that we had in the previous parliament has disappeared, even though it was symbolic. We only had two kind of oppositional candidates or oppositional MPs. But that is gone now. So in terms of where Belarus politically was heading, I think we're seeing a step back. And that is a little bit surprising, given where kind of the discourse about the country and in the country had evolved to over the last couple of years. As you had already said in your introduction, the relationships with Russia have become more difficult related to the 2014 annexation of Crimea. And in the wake of that, we saw that Belarus kind of took its distance as well to being too closely tied to the Russian sphere of influence and has started to reorient a little bit kind of foreign policy. And there was a lot of language about redirecting, for instance, the import of oil or economic relations, tightening those more closely to the West. And that is all becoming more difficult now. So with these elections, which were very far from any of the international standards, Belarus makes it more complicated for Western partners to effectively cooperate with the country. So that distance comes at a moment which is very odd, because Russia is not a natural and easy partner at the moment.
Yeah, both of you have now pointed to a certain movement in Belarusian society, whether it's now reflected in the election result or not. Let's try and explore that a little bit more by focusing on young people in particular. Maria, you were also there on the ground. I mean, how engaged were young people before the election, during the election? Do they participate? Is it in any way a particularly engaged segment of society? What are the trends that you could observe?
I think there are two trends that we should highlight. One trend is that there is a targeted mobilization that is done by the government to bring those students during early voting. And this becomes very clear how those students are targeted. And I think that in this information age, when there is a lot of things that can be put online in terms of like make it public through a publication through WhatsApp group or Telegram channels, it becomes very visible that those students are becoming targeted by the government and influenced to, they were asking them to take part. The dormitories would be notices saying that you should participate in elections. So it indicates that students are the main target, especially students who are located in the dormitories, who receive state scholarships. They are the main target for mobilization by the government. On the other hand, there is another kind of movement from the student, which we can see as a mobilization against certain kind of governmental programs, which is, for example, military conscription for young men. This becomes a very problematic issue in Belarusian society. It makes impossible for young men to continue their education, for example, because they are not able to continue from bachelor to master's. Right now, the conscription allows only one postponement, so only for example, for bachelor studies, not for master studies. And there is a big movement in terms of saying that lets us study, basically lets us continue our education. And this was one of the issues that was mobilizing young people. The second issue is a very harsh law on drug crimes, light drug crimes, which is also kind of combines two groups of people, not just young people, but also relatives, mothers and relatives of people who already received harsh punishments. So this is a group which is called Mothers 328. The 328 is the article that provided this very harsh punishment for these young people. So young people were campaigning for legalization of, for example, marijuana use or legalization of light drug use in terms of as well limiting this harsh punishment for young people. And young people, they called youth bloc for this election campaign. So a number of young candidates supported by Belarusian Gromada Party, which is a renovated party, I would say, because they included a number of young people and supported a number of people who were running this campaign, which also included, for the first time, African Belarusian, for example, girl who was campaigning in her district in Minsk, and I think is very representative because their racial and ethnic profile of youth is changing, and to see a number of representatives in this campaign was noticeable, I would say, and notable for Belarus. So in this regard, there is a plurality of interests that they represent nowadays. The problem, of course, is that it is not counted. And other candidates from Belarusian Republican Youth Union are much more visible in the elected parliament. So they are representing different kind of ideas and interests.
It sounds from what you're saying that the elections provide a platform for mobilization around a number of different ideas and also give the possibility to voice different political ideas. Is it possible to say how much of that is mobilized from the top and how much of it comes from below and is either in opposition to the regime or simply focusing on other issues which are not represented by the regime?
But I think also what we should say why elections actually matter in this regard is that the election mobilize a lot of different political interests. It becomes this very notable moment when different interests are able to mobilize and become public. But it also, there are a lot of institutional restrictions in terms of how the access to the public space. I think there are not that many possibilities for public events in Belarus. And therefore, having running as a candidate, it provides you access to certain kind of public space or access as well to certain media, which is not possible not on election year. So outside the election period, it's very difficult. In this regard, election period campaign provides those opportunities for different voices. But as well, there is this dichotomy between what is happening from bottom up and top down. So of course, from top down, we can see that there was a demand in terms of some people to run in this election. The government clearly stated, including the president, that they wanted to have younger people in the parliament. And this demand was met with a number of decisions to establish younger groups in every party, to have younger candidates in almost like major districts, for example. And this was basically as a resulted in the election of this six young people in the parliament.
Mm-hmm. Felix, you were part of an effort to collect opinion poll data in Belarus here at SOIS. We conducted an online survey of youth in Belarus and various other countries. Can you tell us a little bit about that and what the survey on Belarusian youth showed us in terms of interest in politics, also youth engagement in politics, mm-hmm. and if that's possible to also say if Belarusian youth is different from Belarusian society overall?
Sure. So the first finding that is quite staggering is the low interest in politics that we have amongst young people in Belarus when we do this kind of survey. And I think it relates to what Maria was saying, that even though there is a plurality of interests and young people get involved in various associations and have different interests, there's no representation of these interests in the political process. And we can see that kind of when we asked in February, do you want to participate in the parliamentary elections? 50% of the young people said that they would participate in parliamentary elections. Of course, from February to November, a lot is changing, but still it indicates that many young people don't believe that they're kind of the political diversity of the interest that they have is going to be represented in parliament in a way that is meaningful to them. So it's kind of, it leaves them without a choice, and the protests, a little bit like what we said earlier, if you don't give the signature to the pro-government candidate, that's the way of expressing protest. Or if you don't participate, or if you at least in the survey indicate that you are not going to participate in the parliamentary election, that's a sign of expressing kind of disapproval. And as I said, that goes along with, in general, a low interest in politics compared to values we can find in Poland or Russia, for instance. Nevertheless, what is interesting is that kind of young people engage in political discussion with their friends and colleagues. So similar actually to the values and trends in Poland and Russia, also in Belarus, the level of disagreement is quite significant in political discussion amongst friends. So there is a sense of, you know, there are different views on what one can do politically. It's not similar to what Maria said. It's not a monolithic block where they all agree on, you know, one particular view on where the country should be heading or what should be done. So even though there's no representation, what we can see in even in this autocratic setting is that young people are very contradictory in what they make of their country. One aspect that is maybe interesting, because it's caught so much attention in kind of the two neighboring countries, Poland and Russia, are protests. And obviously public assembly is really complicated in Belarus these days. It's hard to organize. It's costly because you have to pay for the security yourself if you are the organizer. And so that is expressed in the survey that we did by a very low number of people who actually know about protests. So it's less than half of the young respondents who've ever heard of political or social protests in Belarus over the last 12 months. And that compares, kind of to put that in perspective, with a value of more than 90% of Polish youth who know about protests. And also in Russia, the value is significantly higher, with around 60%. And obviously that correlates also with a very low protest participation. So the value in Belarus is less than 3%. So it's fairly negligible of the general youth population of people who got involved.
Mm-hmm. Can we say something about political trust as well in institutions? When we did a similar survey among Russian youth, we found a rather ambivalent picture. We found that Russian youth seems to trust the president, the army, the security forces, but also NGOs. What is the picture like in Belarus?
It's actually very similar. So young people also in Belarus tend to trust NGOs, army, and the security forces significantly more than any of the other institutions. And the trust in the army and the security forces kind of matches also to the levels of trust that we can find amongst broader societies. So these are, in the country, the most kind of trustworthy institutions. And these three, NGO, army, security forces, are followed by the president and the church. The president still gets on average positive trust scores amongst young people, kind of slightly positive, but still. And the church gets slightly negative and very polarized evaluations, which is similar to what we find in Russia, for instance. And then the remaining institutions are by far the most negative. So here we've got the parliament, but also the mayor and kind of local organizations. These are institutions that don't inspire trust to young people in the country.
Mm-hmm. Maria, is it possible to say that there is an official narrative on youth that the regime puts out there, given that youth can be a very important constituency for any regimes, but also for authoritarian regimes?
Yes, sir. I think this is why the demand actually for including youth was voiced at the beginning of their election period. So they are interested in shaping as well how youth participates and how youth is included in the political system. This is also conditional on the fact that Belarus has, first of all, the state program of youth, and second is that it has a certain kind of institutional body in shape of Belarusian Republican Youth Union. So it indicates that they are interested in shaping the official discourse of how, what is youth, how their engagement should be what kind of political engagement is considered appropriate for this political system. One of the kind of interesting element of that was that during the election period, a video of a teacher asking her students to go and vote immediately after was made public. And this kind of question was raised during after the elections to the chairperson of the Central Election Committee. And what she responded, she said, like, yes, we cannot force students, but we can forcefully ask them to participate. So this indicates that this kind of forcefully asking is basically considered as educating youth for getting engaged in politics. And I think this really has to change in terms of, because people, young people participate just through different means and through different channels. But this idea that there is this new generation that we need to develop and enforce a certain kind of narrative of what is politics, what is the state and national identity, this is still very dominant in this regard, that young people are not actors of those politics, but they are kind of reproducing a certain narrative or a certain kind of policies of the government. And this is, I think, dangerous for them as well, because they, by not providing them with voices and actorness, they also miss out on what young people actually want to do and how they want to engage. And I think this is will become a problem for the government.
You've mentioned the official youth union or organization a few times. Can you tell us a little bit about it? Since when does it exist and how many people participate and how successful, if that's the right word, is this organization from the point of view of the political system?
Well, basically, the organization is officially established from 2002. There were other organizations that were prior to this one, but basically the institutionalization of it happened in 2002. It is state-sponsored. It receives state funds for its activities. It's also involved in implementing governmental programs in regards to youth. How successful, it's hard to measure. They claim they have 500,000 supporters, active supporters, but basically each school, each university, they have a cell of this organization. They are represented at different regions, at different in towns, from towns to cities, they are present. So it does indicate that they are spread across the country and they cover a lot of territory more than any other youth organization.
Felix, how does this compare to Russia? I'm wondering also if some of the Russian attempts to shape this official discourse on youth, which we've seen a lot of in the Putin era, and also the Russian state-sponsored youth organizations have perhaps also shaped parts of what is going on in Belarus or vice versa. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe just one short footnote, and that's in the survey we also had this question about the youth union. And what is quite interesting is that less than a third of the young people that we surveyed said that they are members, and kind of they could write down the organization that they are a member. And so one third wrote BRSM, but then many used the remaining space in the text box to say that they were so on a compulsory basis and that they would rather not be a member of it. So I think that's actually quite an interesting indication of kind of the success or the mood around that youth organization. But now to your question, I think what is striking comparing Belarus and Russia is that at least the discourse is even more monolithic. Kind of there's no recognition of the plurality of youth within kind of the state or the official discourse of what youth is. Kind of there's a clear expectation that young people are a key symbolic resource and that they should contribute, in particular what's been happening since 2014, kind of to this reinvention of Belarusian national identity. So we see kind of a new emphasis being placed on medieval history, the Grand Duchy of Lithuania, which young people are supposed to identify with. So in the media, one can see, for instance, that focus groups are being used where young people allegedly said that this period of history, so kind of 14th, 15th to 18th century, is the most important part of the history of Belarus and the most important element for their belonging to a distinct Belarusian kind of national project. And I think that's an interesting example because it shows us, on the one hand, kind of the larger geopolitical orientations of the country between the West and Russia, and it shows us the symbol that youth is becoming in the country, kind of the importance of rooting youth in the past, in the very distant past in that case, and projecting the country into the future. And that kind of symbolic historical inventory that is created goes along with an emphasis on patriotism, which we also find in Russia. There is no official program of patriotic education in Belarus, unlike in Russia. But nevertheless, kind of this, as Maria said, encouraging of citizens to be involved in that way, to protect national culture, to preserving memory, and to become active citizens for the state. And then maybe another point that is important comparing Belarus and Russia is that there's significantly less room for dissenting voices. Kind of it's much harder to mobilize the kind of numbers that you could see in Russia being on the street, and which therefore also challenges this monolithic view on youth, which happens in Russia, but which in Belarus is just much more difficult. And so therefore young people are kind of going to alternative sources of media. I mean, YouTube is coming up as the main source of information in Belarus significantly more often than in Poland and Russia. So we see new media, social media being used, YouTube, Instagram, Vkontakte. These are the kind of ways for young people to go beyond that one-sided discourse that they are exposed to from the politicians.
You just mentioned the word identity, and I wonder, Maria, you also in your doctoral work, which I think is nearing completion, and I think you're only waiting for the defense now. How do you work on a phenomenon that you call everyday nationalism, and some other scholars have called everyday nationalism? What does that mean in the Belarusian context, and can you fit youth into this as well? What kind of nationalism or national identity are we talking about? From the outside, it often seems quite simple to also, or easy to jump to a conclusion that this is still quite Soviet, a Soviet identity, which is probably not the best description. Where do you come in on this, and how do you try to trace these issues in your own research?
In my research, I work mainly with focus group with Belarusian citizens. It's much more diverse than just, I don't just cover young people. So young people are represented in my focus groups, but not just young people. Beyond there, I think my idea was exactly to challenge the idea that there is just one narrative of Belarusian identity. I think there are multiple identity narratives that are very present in Belarusian society, despite it being authoritarian with hegemonic discourse on identity, that people actually, they find their diverse narratives that they can relate to in their personal life, in their everyday life. They as well can make sense of diversity of what is happening in the world, and kind of both engaged with a state narrative, but also engaged with other narratives on Belarus in terms of history, in terms of culture, and they create a narrative that makes sense to them. So they are actors in this identity building mechanism. And what I have observed in my work is that people connect to the idea that Belarus is an independent state. So basically it's kind of also relates to what the government as well promotes, the idea of sovereignty and independence. It also kind of, you can see it within their societal discourses, it's very important for them to maintain this independence. I could also observe their increasing role of culture and their national language. So Belarusian language becomes a certain kind of symbolic indicator, even though it's not used very often in the everyday kind of conversation, it still becomes this very symbolic marker in terms of understanding like who they are, that they belong to the state. So even though sometimes they don't very often talk in this language, it's still a mechanism of identifying themselves as Belarusians. Then, of course, there are other elements that they identify with. It's also similar to what in other countries, it's also landscape and nature and cities where they live in. So it's also an important indicator of identity. If you kind of belong to certain landscapes, they are very, very proud of, you know, lakes and forests. I mean, it's very kind of simple and I think every day, but it's still an important indicator of their identity. So they also identify with a territory, with how this landscape has developed over the years, how Minsk city has changed, for example, or other cities in this region have changed. So all of those are important indications that there is a Belarusian identity that has been shaped during this independence period that is different from the Soviet identity in this regard.
Mm-hmm. Identities are also shaped through or by links people have, not just within their own country, but also beyond. Felix, the Zeus survey also asked Belarusian young people about their migration intentions or existing transnational links, that is, links to family members or friends abroad. What are the trends that you picked up from that? And that behind that is also the possibility that those types of links could shape people's attitudes or maintain certain attitudes. And they don't always have to point only in one direction. But what did you find from the survey?
I think the most interesting finding is probably that around 2/3 of respondents would like to leave their place of residence. So that's an incredibly high value, even compared to other countries in that region. So there's a lot of talk at the moment about the high value of that of the migration intention in Russia, which is now at 53%, after it's previously been at 44%. So we also see an increase there amongst young people. But in Belarus, we have got 2/3 of young people who say they would like to leave. So I think that's an important finding. That's from February, so it might be even higher now. And here the predictors are kind of higher income is the main factor that I guess makes it possible for young people to move. Changes obviously preferences and therefore relates to migration intentions. And people want to go, around 40% of them would like to go to EU countries. So that's the number one destination that attracts. And then the next one is actually the US and Canada, followed then by former Soviet Union countries. Another finding that I found interesting from the survey is how connected young people are to young people or family members and friends outside of their country. So 50% of the people that we surveyed have got links, personal connections to family members or friends in EU countries, and 70% to family members and friends in Russia. So this is huge. I mean, it just shows you how kind of transnational, in a way, the Belarusian demos is, that it's not just contained on this territory, but that it's really influenced by developments that happen east and west of the country. And that's important because it might influence political preferences. Of course, people kind of self-sort, so they have got links. Maybe families who already have a more Western outlook are more likely to have links to families and friends in the West, and inversely for former Soviet Union countries. But nevertheless, it has the potential to shape or at least to maintain political preferences. The other finding that I think is worth underlining is that around half of young Belarusians have travel experiences abroad. So that's also a huge factor for getting to know the world. I mean, even if you live in an autocratic society, kind of going places obviously changes what you think about what is the right and the good society that you want to live in. Kind of you see consumption opportunities, you see how people interact on the street, and that obviously has an impact on what you would like to do in your daily life. So 50% is quite a lot for a country that has a low purchasing power and where mobility beyond the country itself is not particularly easy. And primarily, of course, young people move for tourism. So that's kind of 2/3 of the 50% who have left Belarus over the last 12 months. But even the effect of tourism, I would not underestimate that on what people expect from their day-to-day life and what they think is the normal.
Mm-hmm. I think we've covered quite a lot. Let me, at the end, ask you both to very briefly sum up what you think are the prospects for stability or change, and what kind of change in Belarus, and where youth enters that picture. Maria.
I think that the most important part as well, where it leads us, is that next year will be the presidential elections. So I think that it will be interesting as well how youth and this young people who engaged in the parliamentary election as oppositional forces, how they will kind of further engage in this other campaign, because there will be even more limited space for them to actually to promote their agenda and to be more engaged in the public space. So whether there will be any kind of possibilities for them to be active and to voice their different perspectives on the politics, this will be definitely something to monitor and to follow up.
Mm-hmm. And Felix?
Yeah, I do agree. On the other hand, of course, homegrown change seems to be really difficult to realize. I mean, it is a very restrictive environment, so it somehow needs to also come maybe from abroad. It depends a little bit on how Western partners will behave, if they kind of drop Belarus now after these parliamentary elections, or if they continue engagement or increase engagement. Because what is interesting in the run-up to the presidential elections now is that there is a great degree of disaffection within the political system. I mean, the kind of most famous oppositional blogger, he claims that he gets a lot of information from people who are part of the system and who feed him information. So people are, even though they might be working for for different ministries, they're not supporting the system as it stands. And that gives potential for change and gives an element of unpredictability. So I think that's important to watch how that plays out. And of course, that dysfunctional marriage that we have between Russia and Belarus. There's a lot to watch out in that regard, because also Russia is changing quickly at the moment, has its own succession problem to manage. And that links very closely to the space of possibilities of Belarusian politics as well.
Thank you very much, Maria. Thank you, Felix. And we will continue our discussion about youth in Belarus and other parts of Eastern Europe. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.